I'm Yossi Selig, and I'm the host of Bandsplain, a show where we explain cult bands and iconic artists by going deep into their histories and discographies. We're back with a brand new season at our brand new home, the Ringer Podcast Network, tackling a whole new batch of artists, from grunge gods to power pop pioneers to new metal legends and many, many more. Listen to new episodes every Thursday, only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, Hungry Dogs Run Slower today, it's Andy Greenwald!
Just be gentle with me.
My God. My best friend. my rock.
Yeah.
Andy and I we come to you on a Monday after the Philadelphia Eagles lost to the Dallas Cowboys, as everybody is now kind of pivoted to this being a Philadelphia Eagles podcast. I wanted to open up the floor, Andy, for some comments and some concerns, if you wanted to get that off your chest.
No. I mean, it's not about the team. I mean, nobody likes to lose on national television badly.
Yeah.
Two straight weeks.
Yep.
That's not a thing people sign up for, generally. There are some pluses here.
Uh-huh.
Jay Ferguson is happy.
Yes. This one of the stars of your television show, Briar Patch, Jay Ferguson.
I was like, is he going to say masterpiece?
One wow. of the stars, one of the most important things that ever happened to me.
He's happy. We got to see each other.
Yeah.
Briefly.
Yeah.
Before I ran out crying. I think that this won't come as a surprise to people who listen to the podcast who know that I tend to... I think I run a little hot sometimes emotionally in my connection to things.
Yes.
And like first 4 minutes of all entertainment.
It's interesting to watch
first,
that yeah. in real life, yeah. in real time. Because uh-huh. I think usually what happens is you'll text me and just be like, oh man, I'm not so into this TV show. Or like, I quit. This is stupid. This
yeah,
TV
and
show.
You're such a nice guy. You just tolerate it.
But I'm not usually in the room with you as you are going
right.
through that process. And within two plays of this Eagles game against the Cowboys, you were like, I would like to eject myself through the ceiling.
I was not in a good headspace. I mean, I think that broadly, I would say, and I've said this before, I'm a bad sports fan in that I take my little glass menagerie of emotional
yeah.
well-being
yeah.
and I hand it over to Lane Johnson and Jason Kelce
yeah.
and the rest of the Eagles offensive line. And I get what I deserve, frankly, for doing that and not taking better care of the better boundaries for myself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, we're, you know, I think there's still a lot of football to be played.
Let's turn the camera around here and say that, like, you are the guy everyone imagines you to be. You're a rock. you were keeping it light. You were playing with a 2-year-old.
Uh-huh.
You were
you make it sound like I just found one on the street.
You brought one. It was like, oh, I brought a 6-pack. What'd you bring? No, you were Uncle Chris.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed.
Thanks, man. I mean, I think that we only get this one life here, you know, and I'm not gonna let Nick Sirianni decide how I feel on a Sunday night. I like watching sports a lot.
Yeah.
I don't love losing, but it's all part of the experience, you know?
That's incredible. You just need to teach me.
Andy, I thought maybe we could start, today,
yeah.
here's a table of contents.
Okay.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the TV nominations for the Golden Globes, mm-hmm. because those came out this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And while I still am dubious about the how rigorous the Golden Globe voting and nomination process is, even though it's no longer solely the job of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to decide these things. I do think it is the first shot of the award season in earnest. We've had like a couple of other film mm-hmm. awards, but this is the first time we'll get to see some of these titles all strung together and get a sense of what, quote, this town thinks of the TV slate from mm-hmm. the year. And I also wanted to talk to you about The Curse.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk a little bit about Leave the World Behind, sure. a movie from our buddy Sam Esmail.
Yeah.
I had a new little gimmick I wanted to try out on you this weekend, though. This week.
Yeah.
On a Monday.
Can you tell the people why you were so productive last night? I really thought that was a... I appreciated that.
I got home and I said to myself, Philadelphia is not going to be a total failure tonight. I'm going to get something done. So I watched The Gilded Age with my wife. We had a delightful time. And the Brooklyn Bridge opened on this episode. Oh. FYI, no spoilers. And
do you want to know how that turned out?
Well, I learned a lot. Did you know that it was, according to The Gilded Age, that the Brooklyn Bridge was largely, the construction was overseen by Emily Roebling? The wife of the person who
sounds like the woke mind virus at work. Come on.
Anyway.
I don't know a lot about the Brooklyn Bridge. That is interesting.
Yeah.
It's great that you're getting your
American history from Gilded Age. But I thought we could introduce a topic for Mondays here when we're just kind of...
Just feeling it out?
Yeah, just feeling it out, and it's the watch of the weekend.
Are you predicting there are going to be some grim Mondays going forward?
No, but I think that I think that we've found ourselves with large gaps in the TV schedule from time to time,
or
shows are airing on days that more suit themselves to the Thursday pod. Mm-hmm. So the watch of the weekend, I was just, this could be literally anything.
Okay.
You know, on our podcast art, not only are our two youthful faces featured.
I don't know what you're talking about,
but
I look the same.
But there's, icons for music, books, film, and TV. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I think time is a flat circle and we don't always have to be on the cutting edge of something that was released in a second. So if there was anything that you watched this weekend.
Okay.
And I use that in quotation marks. It could be music. It could be a book. It could be a magazine article. It could be anything that you felt like, I really enjoyed that. I want to recommend this to people out there.
I watched my Super Bowl dreams crumble. No, I did... I did watch two things. You're going to be surprised.
I'm not going to be surprised.
You're not?
No.
Because I tell you everything that I do.
But I mean, I'm not going to be surprised because you love the arts.
Thank you. I'm passionate. I'm passionate about the arts. I saw a film this weekend.
Uh-huh.
I saw a film that I really, really don't want to call The Boy and the Heron because that's the dumbest title change in recent history.
What do you mean? What's the original
The project
title?
Is called How Do You Live?
Oh.
It's based on a decades old book called How Do You Live? The name is relevant, like in the text of the movie, and it's also a beautiful name for this beautiful movie.
Uh-huh.
And The Boy and the Heron sounds like somebody was just like, God, I don't know what to do with this metaphysical shit. Like kids like birds, huh? Like I just want to be in that meeting.
So you don't think Miyazaki had anything to say about what this thing was titled?
I think he has a lot of control over most things.
Okay.
But I don't know. He's an older man.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in octogenarians' ability to lead their enterprises.
Absolutely.
I am all in on that as a
shout out to Joe Biden for going to Philly today. He's in Philly to give a grant to the fire department. And I think that's bold. I think that's bold leadership. When a city is crumbling, when a city is caving in.
Can he give
Joe Biden is like, let's make this into Helm's Deep here, baby.
Can he give a grant to our secondary, like an exemption from salary cap? And anyway, I saw Boy and the Heron, which is the new, potentially final film by one of the great masters of, frankly, of cinema.
Yeah.
Hayao Miyazaki.
I hear great things.
Yeah. You hear great things. One thing about that guy is you know how to say his name consistently. You're a big fan. It's a masterpiece. It really is. And it's just absolutely, it's really incredible. And it is.
What's it about?
Well, so there's this boy. And then... Well,
and is there a heron?
There is.
So it's a pretty good title then when you think about it.
Okay, Joe Hollywood. Like, just make it simple for me. Is there a bird in this movie? If so, you put that in the title. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't call it like just 3 days of paranoia. They called it 3 days of the condor.
Exactly.
And then you were in.
If it was just like, I'm nervous because my office got shot up, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have watched it.
No.
It was called 3 days of the condor. I was like, yeah.
Cool, birds. So it is it's sort of hard to describe because it is a summation of everything that he's ever done in his career. It is remarkable. It is so deeply suffused with references and images and themes and obsessions from every film he's made across his career, from Other Worlds Falling from the Sky, from old crones, from talking animals, to the violence and trauma of the war in the Pacific on a generation of people in Japan. It's suffused with all of that, but done with like the same perspective that I would say. It's not out of hand to compare him to Scorsese in the sense that they're both in this late period where they're making movies that are of a piece with everything they've ever made, but their perspective on what motivates them and what inspires their art and the emotion surrounding it is deeper and richer. And I was really moved by this movie. So I didn't give you it. It's about a kid who evacuates from Tokyo with his father after his mother dies during the war and is living with his aunt, who his father is now marrying.
Ooh.
And now you're interested. I never know which is your way in. And he sort of finds a hidden world.
Yeah.
That's connected to his family, that's connected to the loss of his mother, that's connected to birds. They're birds. I can't tell if that's really your driver, but it's a really beautiful film.
So, Andy, you are going to be on The Big Picture this week talking about this film with Sean.
And I'll talk more clearly, I promise.
No, I mean, you're doing a great job selling it to, obviously, I'm like, you know, I'm flying a little bit blind here, as birds do sometimes. Mm. But, I you know, if people want to hear like a more in-depth conversation about this film, Andy's going to be on Big Pick with Sean and Charles Holmes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
We won't be doing any drafts, though. That's your bag.
It is. It's strangely, and I never win, but I've become something of a draft maven at the Ringer Podcast Network. I go on Bandsplane and do it. Okay. My watch of the weekend was Saturday Night Live, which I don't think I've watched live in well over 5 years. But I enjoy waking up and then like taking a look at the viral content that's produced from it. Mm-hmm. And this weekend it was hosted by the person who I've kind of decided is my favorite movie star, all in all, which is Adam Driver. And I believe Driver's hosted before. He was hosted with Olivia Rodrigo as the musical guest. So it's a holiday episode. I always kind of enjoy holiday themed, like sort of holiday vibed episodes of the talk shows and the variety shows towards the end of the year. It seems like they have like a real spirit of the season, and Driver was awesome. I watched his monologue. It was really funny. He did a song at a piano about his Christmas list for Santa. And then three or four of the like better sketches I've seen in a while. Like I said, I don't watch it live, but I do watch a bunch of the sketches like as they're kind of aggregated and curated in blog posts, which I guess is pathetic, but is also the way I happen to ingest Saturday Night Live. But he was really, really funny. And also, like, a couple of these sketches, he seemed, like, off book. Like, he maybe learned the lines.
So he's committed.
Yeah. And I was just like, this dude just played Enzo Ferrari, and he's, like, processing, like four or five sketches on Saturday Night Live. You could see him looking at cue cards a couple of times, but there's I highly recommend people check out the Beep Beep sketch.
Okay.
You can look that up. And also the sketch where he plays a unit manager of an apartment building in Hollywood at a FYC event.
Oh, that's relevant to our interest.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Have we been misreading him for a while? Because definitely his public image has been very serious.
Yes.
You know, and he seemed miserable during any like Star Wars related press run. There's always the stories about how he can't watch anything that he's in. He becomes physically ill and has to leave. It just felt like heavy. There's a heaviness.
Yeah.
And he's been playing heavies. I mean, he's a
he had
a
viral moment
actor
recently when somebody asked him, like, somebody at a Ferrari screening was like, some of their race scenes look cheesy, and he was just like, fuck you, like what do you want me to say?
I respect that.
Yeah.
But I, for recently, for other reasons, I was rewatching some of Girls, the first season, and I just forget that he is deeply funny. It's not like he was very much in on the performance he was giving. This wasn't just like he went method and they filmed him away to make him look silly. Like, he gets it. He just doesn't get a lot of comic opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at his filmography, and there, you know, you could make one argument, which is that outside of Star Wars, he hasn't had a lot of huge box office successes.
Right.
But I would make the argument that he routinely has the best taste of any working lead actor. You can basically go back to when he sort of debuts in the films with like Francis Ha and Lincoln, and all the way through Llewyn Davis. While We're Young, he's worked a couple of times with Jim Jarmusch. He's worked a couple of times with Noah Baumbach, obviously. He was in Logan Lucky. And basically, all the work he does around the Star Wars movies he's in is fascinating. Black Klansman, The Report, Marriage Story. And then this run that he's been on in the last 2 years of Last Duel, House of Gucci, White Noise, 65, which I didn't see, and Ferrari, which I have seen.
You're not alone in 65. But
I know.
That's the one weird one, that he took that. But, I mean, private school's expensive in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and then next year he's going to be appearing in Francis Ford Coppola's long-awaited dream projects, Megalopolis.
I mean, he's
already stuttering because I couldn't pronounce that.
You saw it coming. You got nervous. He's the director's guy. He's an interesting case because he is a movie star because movie directors want to work with him.
Yeah.
And he's going to keep getting these parts because, he's good, but you're right about the box office thing. It's interesting to see him and Chalamet navigate the post-DiCaprio rules, which is, famously DiCaprio's like, no capes, no hard drugs.
Yes.
We can't speak to the latter.
Right.
But they both seem to be following DiCaprio in the other category, Well, there's Dune and there's Star Wars.
Yeah.
They're doing franchise things, which makes sense, but they're trying to be careful about what they choose. Driver is not Reed Richards.
Right.
And I don't think, we don't know how, quote unquote, close that got, but there's no question that he was on Feige's list.
There was a very funny period of Marvel rumors where it was like Adam Driver has rejected the latest version of the Fantastic Four script.
They kept coming to him for it. But it is a thing, and I think we were talking about this with Emma Stone recently.
Emma Stone.
Was talking about it with I call her Emily. That's actually her real name, But then I brought it to you, and I said a friend of mine, but I didn't want to make you uncomfortable.
Put me out.
That this is a path that is unfairly, but more often open to male actors, which is I will just find the people. You're not going to go wrong. You may not be as rich or famous in the short term, but if you just glom on to the good filmmakers and fill your slate with at least one Jarmusch, one Wes Anderson, one Noah Baumbach, you stick with them.
Yeah.
Kelly Reichardt or whatever, and then
you can kind of blossom from there.
You'll keep working.
Yeah.
And you'll feel more fulfilled, and that seems to be what their plan is. You going to see Wonka?
I don't think I'll see Wonka. Do you think you'll see Ferrari?
That was beautifully done. That's why some people are like, those guys agree too much. And then with just one casual turn of phrase,
say,
you reveal the difference between us.
When we were together watching the football game last night, there was a long advertisement for Wonka. And at some point, a micro-sized Hugh Grant with a green face was floating around.
Oompa Loompa. Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck is going on?
Yes.
And everybody was like, that's an Oompa Loompa. And I was like, I don't really know anything about this stuff.
You don't remember the Gene Wilder version?
I don't think I ever saw it.
Not even as a kid?
No. It never spoke to me.
Travel baseball?
Yeah.
No, I get it. All these rites of childhood where your parents are like, Chris, come sit on our knee and watch this beloved
and
film.
I was and you're no, like, me and my 12-year-old double play partner, we must achieve perfection.
Sorry, I got to go hit some fungos with Chet.
Yeah. Oh, dude, every fucking guy on my team was named Danny or Joey.
Yeah, it's the 80s.
Yeah. Andy, you want to talk about the Golden Globes? Something we haven't really done in earnest in quite some time.
I don't know if anyone's done it in earnest.
So the Golden Globes were always a punching bag and then always a party. So it's like the sort of everybody made fun of the Golden Globes because it had this, as you always pointed out, this cabal of
shadowy cabal of international weirdos.
There you go. And that was the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Mm-hmm. That was the voting block for this. And everybody was kind of like, who are these people? Do they just live entirely on junkets and free trips and things like that?
Yes.
They sort of immolated in a just a sea of controversy, too numerous to go through. But you can read our buddy Zach Barron's piece about Brendan Fraser in GQ magazine from a few years back that really got into it. It essentially spelled the beginning of the end for the HFPA and for the Globes as an awards. We thought until Todd Boehly, who also owns Chelsea Football Club.
And
you hate to see what's happening there with Chelsea. They've spent quite a few billions of pounds on players in their 11th. But, my heart goes out to them.
Wow.
And so Todd Boehly,
international shade from CR,
and Penske Media kind of collaborated here, where they picked up the rights to the HFPA, I believe it's now, or to the Golden Globes, and now it's a Dick Clark Productions production.
And Dick Clark, historically, Dick Clark Productions had produced the television show,
yes,
the Golden Globes.
Yes, and it's
still
involved.
But they've now taken over the entire entity, right?
Yeah.
There's no longer a Hollywood Foreign Press. Oh, there is, but it's not. That's not who runs the Golden Globes anymore.
And now there's this, like, I think from what I understand, essentially, members of the HFPA are now paid journalists by the Golden Globes website, where they're like a salaried employee who write content for this website and report on.
There's still a website that pays?
I think so.
I got to get that.
Yeah, you got to get on that. You're like, y'all like Larry McMurtry books?
You guys need a TV critic?
Yeah.
I'm back.
There's still some ethical dilemmas, I think, here, but it does seem like between Boehly and I believe this is going to be on CBS? Live on CBS. Okay. So this will be broadcast on CBS on Sunday, January 7th. And it's noted that, like, the Golden Globes are thought of as the fun, drunken, lout younger brother of the Oscars.
And that is not CBS.
It sort of starts the award season with a boozy party. And, you know, if you were going to watch, maybe I would recommend, if you're an awards agnostic person who doesn't feel the need to watch the SAGs and the DGAs and everything and go through all and the Independent Spirit Awards or the Gotham Awards or whatever, you can watch the Globes and the Oscars and have a pretty clear picture of what award season was. And I also recommend doing it that way, because then you don't see people do their speeches four times.
That's
and when
the
they
worst.
Win the Oscar, you're like, I've heard about this.
He did it better at SAG.
I heard about your acting teacher. Mm-hmm. Let's go through some of the television nominees.
Can we also say...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Before we get into the
specifics, can say whatever you want.
No, it's just... I'm feeling my way through this take, but I kind of respect this more because they're just like, look, we just want to give more trophies out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of more honest that this is also totally random,
yeah,
and has no history or foundation or connection to, like, we have no idea what the preferences are. I mean, again,
it's an IP test. It's like there are two words that go together, Golden Globes, and we're going to see whether or not people will still watch it, even though it has no,
And, you know, we say this every time around the awards season. It's always arbitrary. It's always subjective. I think over our colleagues on The Big Picture, like Sean and Amanda, do a great job every year of sort of contextualizing what Oscar nominations mean. But you can do that because the Academy that votes on the Oscars have been doing it for years, and they are a living entity that takes on members, that sheds membership and changes slowly or awkwardly sometimes in response to the times. And you can sort of take a long view of it. That's interesting. This, they're like, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. So it's a blank slate. We have no idea. But in a way, it's pragmatic. That I kind of appreciate, because there's a lot of the talk around Hollywood and what Hollywood feels like right now post-strikes is terror, fearful. Nobody actually knows what's going on in 2024 in terms of, like, what's getting greenlit, what services are going to exist, all these things. But then the wiser, older heads that I've spoken to are like, yeah, it's chaos right now because nobody knows what the ground is. But once the ground is set, people will get back. It's like nature heals. It's like those dolphins in the Venice canals.
Well, do you think
in 2025, people will be making shows again, because that's what people are wired to do. And so the reason I bring it up in relation to the Golden Globes is they give awards.
Yeah.
They give awards. So let's just cut the bullshit, put on a party, and see what happens.
Well, I'm going to save my follow-up questions about your wise sage friends that you have.
One is Emma Stone. I'm glad you asked.
Good. Okay. So let's just run through some of these nominations for TV, because what I do think it does is paint a useful picture of the year in television. So for TV drama, the nominees are 1923 on Paramount Plus,
sure,
The Crown, The Diplomat on Netflix, The Last of Us on HBO, The Morning Show on Apple, and Succession on HBO. The comedy or musical, always some fun category manipulation going on here. The Bear, which is here because it's 30 minutes long, typically, or around 30 to 40 minutes long. Ted Lasso, Abbott Elementary, Jury Duty, Only Murders in the Building, and Barry, which is
one of the darkest dramas of the
sometimes
last
funny, but is truly one of the most harrowing things you can watch.
Mm-hmm.
Best limited series, anthology series, or motion picture made for television. Mm-hmm. That goes to Beef, Lessons in Chemistry, Daisy Jones and the Six, All the Light We Cannot See, Fellow Travelers, and Fargo. And I thought I would just throw in a couple other things here. What do I have? Best performance by an actor in a drama. Pedro Pascal for Last of Us, Kieran Culkin for Succession, Jeremy Strong for Succession, Brian Cox for Succession, Gary Oldman for Slow Horses, yeah. Dominic West for The Crown, and Best Actress in a Television Series Drama. That's Helen Mirren in 1923, Bella Ramsey in Last of Us, Carrie Russell in The Diplomat, Sarah Snook in Succession, Imelda Staunton in The Crown, and Emma Stone in The Curse.
My friend.
Sometimes you look at these nominees, and there's a bunch more. I wanted to hit one more category with you, but you look at these nominees, and you're like, someone somewhere is very wise about who they would like to see in a crowd shot at an award
show. I thought you were talking about the Bridget Everett Show.
Oh, no, not Somebody Somewhere.
Yeah.
To that point, though, Somebody Somewhere, a lovely show that would be buoyed and lifted up by awards recognition, but like they want to make sure that they've got Jennifer Lawrence in here, and they've got Emma Stone in here, and that they've got Carrie Russell and Helen Mirren and the cast of Succession. And it's just very notable how these all work. And I think that the ultimately the musical or comedy bifurcation that they do of shows allows them to just get as much star power
well,
as possible.
Well, for movies, certainly.
Well, and but in TV too.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but the Emmys do that too.
Okay.
But like with the, they divide the categories. Yeah. But you're right. I have to say, I'm looking over this list again, and it's like, I don't really have any problems with it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
there are some shows that we haven't watched. There are some shows I don't love as much as the Golden Globes seem to love.
Exactly. But this is a fair enough slice of what people were watching or talking about or considering in 2023. It is absolutely plausible. And my guess is that was the main criteria for this nouveau iteration of the Golden Globes. Like, let's not be clowns.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That said, one of the things about the Globes that I have appreciated in the past is every so often there would just be something that was so clearly bought, like just so clearly bribed or you know, FYC'd, like personal FYC, like would you consider this person coming to your home, that it really stood out, but that made it a little bit different and made it a little bit more interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm comparing this, like, this is the week that you and I are also making our top 10 list, and our shows, are a lot of my top 10 here? No, but the top ones are.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see it. I have a suspicion that this year, our top 10s, I wouldn't speak for Kaya in this situation, but no. I would imagine she might agree with us, that we're going to all have very similar top 4 or 5s.
Yeah.
And then wildly divergent 6 through 10s.
Yes. And, you know, don't hold me to this. I may even reverse this take in this podcast, but I'm feeling a little nostalgic for mass content. Mm. Like, The Diplomat, I still have not checked out. I might just watch an episode or two this week, not because it's going to be on my top 10, but because for the reasons I'm about to say, which is a lot of people watched it.
Yeah.
A lot of people I know watched. I've heard varying opinions about it. Some people thought it was good. Some people thought it was bad. Both groups watched it, you know, and I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think that it's interesting to have programs that draw a wide audience of people of disparate feelings about it.
You know what shows do that?
Tell me.
Netflix shows.
Well, because they're watched.
Yes.
And that's really the only reason at this point. I totally agree with you. But I'm not, but like, that doesn't make me upset to see it there, you know, and 1923, I watched a couple episodes. I didn't think it was great. But again, like, the Sheridanverse should be, attention must be paid.
Yeah, it should be recognized, I think. I will leave a lot of the sort of divining of nominations and figuring that stuff out about in the movies department to the big picture. But I did want to ask you about one special new category they've introduced here, which is cinematic and box office achievement. And this is something that I feel like they almost beat the Oscars to the punch to on this one, because there's long been a suggestion that the Oscars need to get a little bit more wide angle and a little bit more populist and start bringing in more blockbuster movies somehow, so that more people feel like an engagement, or like that they have a horse in the race. And for the most part, you know, like, a normal person probably sees 8 to 10 movies a year, maybe. I don't know. I don't know how often people, Joe Public, goes to the movies. I would imagine that half, if not more, are blockbusters, and then maybe they see like a couple of the year-end Best Picture nominees, and that's pretty much their movie-going year, and then maybe they catch up with everything else on streaming. cinematic and box office achievement is the HFPA's, or rather the Golden Globes' effort to sort of just get a bunch of really big titles mm-hmm. involved. And I presumably have folks there. Now, I believe Barbie got the most nominations out of the Golden Globes at all, but Barbie heads this list of cinematic and box office achievement. It's Barbie, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, John Wick Chapter 4, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, Oppenheimer, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, the Super Mario Brothers movie, and maybe the most cynical act of all time, the Taylor Swift film.
Super, super cynical. Yeah, can I talk about this?
Please do.
This is really stupid because, no, let me be clear. Acknowledging and celebrating big popcorn movies is a good idea. And as you said, the Oscars have been hemming and hawing and gnashing their teeth over this literal category for so long, the Globes just took it.
Yeah.
Which is fair.
And if the Oscars had a list this year, and I think you should probably, maybe to be fair, make it, you can either be a Best Picture nominee or you can be in this category,
right.
But you can't be both. But I would be, I think it would be pretty exciting if like Tom Cruise, Chris Pratt, Taylor Swift, Keanu Reeves, like yeah. all showed up for an award show because of this.
They won't.
Yeah.
But what's really dumb about the selection for this category is like, you know what the achievement for these movies is? Money. Like they won the achievement.
Yeah.
And if you're just lumping in movies that made a lot of money, it seems incredibly cynical and dumb because you're not saying that these were special achievements in any way other than the fact that they achieved millions and millions of dollars around the world.
Right.
Which is a bummer because some of these movies are extremely good. Some of these movies are good enough to have been, as you said, nominated in the real categories.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer and Barbie are nominated for Best Drama and Best Comedy / Musical, respectively. That kind of should be enough. I mean, I don't know. Then you end up going down the cul-de-sac that the Oscars have been in for years, which is Spider-Verse. I mean, I'm with Sean. Like, that was Sean's, one of his top three mm-hmm. movies of the year, right? It is for me, too. One of my other top three movies of the year is Past Lives. Past Lives was nominated for the Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm.
It's thrilling. Celine Song was nominated for Best Director for Past Lives. She'd never directed anything before. That's exciting.
Yeah.
If you do the sort of dream version of what the Oscars have talked about heading towards for years, and Spider-Verse gets nominated, and you know, the other worthy things here get nominated, it probably pushes out of Past Lives. So I don't really see the way forward here. I guess I wish that this category had more to say about what it was trying to curate.
Yeah, it's like, should it be the best film that makes a baseline of $200 million? Like
best blockbuster?
Yeah.
I think the problem is then you start getting... The thing that they're trying to avoid doing, but they've now backed themselves into the corner, is litigating what this category is, which is basically saying, you're good for what you are.
Right.
Who sets that floor? Because every so often, you get a movie like Barbie or Spider-Verse, which is just good. And it's also a right. billion-dollar grosser.
I mean, I think that if we're just having this conversation, which we're... This is why we do a podcast. I would say that my biggest frustration right now is how bottlenecked we are at the end of years with good movies mm-hmm. and how they basically have made it so, with few exceptions, the sort of year-end films, the award season films must all come out within a 6-week. And yeah, it can feel awesome and you can feel stimulated because you're every... Maybe twice a week you're seeing May, December, and then Leave the World Behind, and then you're going to go see mm-hmm. Napoleon, then Ferrari, or something like that. But I think that the year would benefit with a more evenly distributed amount of good films. That's like my big pet peeve with
yes.
the way that award season works.
It's very weird that with all the innovations and in how movies are released, that hasn't been reconsidered.
But I would say with this cinematic achievement thing, one thing that I got the sense of, especially with Top Gun Maverick, was... it was almost being used, you know, like it was mm-hmm. in no way was it sincerely being thought of as a Best Picture candidate last year. And I wonder whether or not there's a little bit of a backfiring going on when you basically have like, if you were going to nominate John Wick Chapter 4 for a Best Picture nominee,
right.
It would not win.
But you like that, right? You think it's good?
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, I did not.
It was, you would actually love, of all the John Wick movies, I don't know if you've seen it, but like any of them, but you would love John Wick 4.
I'm not against this project.
Yeah, there's parts of John Wick 4 that is like, this is a Buster Keaton film.
It's cool.
But if you nominated that for Best Picture with the hopes of getting some John Wick heads to watch the Oscars, but really with no chance whatsoever of seriously competing, mm-hmm. I don't know that that necessarily helps. You know, it's like, just having these popular movies there as keywords doesn't matter. So if you were to create a category in which something could be awarded to these films, which have achieved the thing that movies desperately want the most, which is popularity,
yeah,
then I think that that would be good.
Yeah, I just think there's something about this category that rubs me the wrong way because it's just so cynical. Like, I saw the Super Mario Brothers movie within the first 2 weeks of it opening.
Yes.
My children were excited to see it.
You, Nick Sirianni, Dom from the Eagles, you guys all went opening night.
We all wore matching sweatshirts.
I would honestly give you $1,000 if you got a visor with an Italian flag on it.
I feel like I couldn't pull it off for a variety of reasons, but thank you. We saw this movie. I'm very proud of my children who are open-hearted young women who are like, that wasn't good. They enjoyed seeing it. They're not angry about it. They're happy we went, but they knew even at their younger ages that this is not good.
Yeah.
It's just ticking some boxes and was a fine way to spend an hour and a half eating Junior Mints and gummy bears.
Right.
Great. That shouldn't be here. It's not good. You know what I mean? Good job for Universal. Good job, Illumination. You made €1 billion, but similarly, like, I don't know if anybody is saying the Taylor Swift movie, which I'm very eager to see.
Well, you're going to be able to pay for it.
Cinematic
this
achievement.
This weekend, I believe, yeah.
You know, I think people are like, that gave people something wonderful that they love, but Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, nobody's saying that's good?
Some people are.
Are they?
Didn't you?
No.
Did you see it?
Yes.
I thought Sean was like, that's the real one. That's the last good Marvel movie that we're going to get.
Well, it's probably the last decent Marvel movie. It's the last Marvel movie that has like human fingerprints on it.
Right.
But mostly the fingerprints are like raccoon fingerprints. It's
a little pause.
It's entirely about like animal experimentation.
No, I heard about that. That's not my favorite kind of story. So I've not seen it yet. Honestly, I know it's weird to be like, I don't want to see Rocket get traumatized.
That's not your favorite story?
Yeah. I had an experience when I was a kid when my parents took me to go see the Matthew Broderick film Project X.
I know everything you're about to say.
Yeah. And I really didn't like it. I did not enjoy, and I still to this day do not really like animal cruelty in films.
Mm-hmm. Yet you love John Wick 4. So messed up.
Well,
like the people have it coming.
This is now four films of him taking out revenge for his dog. I mean,
oh,
like,
okay, so he's on your side.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we're going to talk about The Curse in the context of what's on right now. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about Leave the World Behind. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details. We're back. Andy, I wanted to talk about The Curse, and I wanted to do it in a way that was a little bit more of a survey of what's on right now. We love to power rank things
here. I want to talk about the real estate market in New Mexico.
We could do that, too. I'm trying to feel out where mm-hmm. you're at with this show, because
I'm ready to tell you.
Okay.
Well, what are you worried? Because you worried that it's not...
I would say that The Curse has been a fascinating week-to-week watch, mm-hmm. and this is my failure as a opinion haver and as a takesman. I just don't
the first order it takes.
I don't feel shout out to Greatest of All Talk Pod. They're the takesmans. I don't feel like I am coming out of each episode with the curse with like a ton to say. I'm deeply admiring the craft and the performances. I laugh, I cringe, I see where some of it is going, but for some reason, I'm also like, I am waiting to find out that this is all happening in a diorama shaken up by an angry god. You know, like, you could tell me anything is going to be a twist in the second half of the season. And I am finding it moves at such like a slow and incremental pace in some ways, because it's so, I don't even know what to say. It's almost like the stories all feel like B stories, within the story of the show itself. Like, I still don't know what is.
So your feeling is that it is a collection of potential stories under the umbrella of the idiosyncratic interests of the people making the show.
Yes. And it's a vibe densely first. Plotted and actually very well plotted and well told story. But I did not, I guess maybe this is an expectations thing where it's like, I did not think that we would be now 5+ hours into this series and still talking about like which like sort of fake internet influencer meets Whitney's standards for occupation of one of her passive homes.
So I completely empathize with that feeling. And that is generally where I had been over the last few weeks. I thought this was the best episode of the series to date. This is episode 5. It's called It's a Good Day. I think we could table for the moment the conversation over whether it's a good idea to wait 5 episodes to kind of reach the point, reach the main body of your story.
Yeah.
I mean, in the scheme of things, I guess it's a 10-episode series. This is the midpoint. So everything up to now was table setting, and now we're at the table, and then everything else will be either eating the meal, I guess, or throwing all the dishes into the fire like an extravagant Greek wedding.
Right.
TBD. I thought this was, now look, this is still the curse. It's still the people, it's still Safdie and Fielder. And so I don't have a super chill time watching this. I would say my body language was worse during my viewing of episode 5 of The Curse than it was during the first half of Eagles Cowboys, which, you know, as you saw, was not awesome. But I was locked in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's for two reasons. One, this was the show that I think we were promised over a year ago when it was described, that it was about a couple making a, I mean, they said home renovation show. It's not that, but a HGTV type show. This was about the filming of an episode of that show.
Yes.
And also about their real life foibles and interconnected stresses and anxieties and backstories and like the actual real estate business that they're trying to run behind this, the falseness of all of it brought to the fore. It was also, but the second reason why I think it was excellent is because it was just a showcase for Emma Stone, who is the single best reason to watch the show, whose performance is so wild, so compelling, and totally unique. And so because of that, I felt more grounded, even though I'm never, ever comfortable watching this episode.
Do you see what I'm saying though? Where I'm like, there's something about I resisted like getting too far into any of the discourse about the show because I didn't want to find out that in episode 7 or 8, like it truly starts to blow your mind what they're doing. Because I actively anticipate that. And if there's one show on TV right now that I feel like is got the potential for everybody stop what you're doing and you have to watch the latest episode of The Curse because you won't believe what happened, it's The Curse. Or Fargo, I think, is good, but I kind of have a sense of where it's moving. You know, Slow Horses, the pleasures of that show are very obvious and very, you know, even if there's twists and turns, I think they've figured out what Slow Horses is and how to do it. Murder at the End of the World, I've been keeping up with, and I'm just, because I'm a mystery addict, need to see this filled out, but I think I have a sense of like what that show is trying to do. I don't really know what the curse is trying to do. And I think that's exciting. I think it's also sometimes a challenge. But it is the show that I think has the potential to be the breathtaking, I never thought that this was going to happen moment, which is not necessarily the only thing television can do or the reason I watch television.
Yeah.
But I guess I keep waiting for that moment to happen.
I think I don't disagree with you, but at the same time, I think the reasons I liked this one were the opposite of that. Because I felt like the show had plateaued in its situation, in its setting, in its setup. We understood the, again, I'm never comfortable watching the show, but I felt more settled mm-hmm. in the premise, or at least in the boundaries of this episode, because it was an episode about filming an episode. And because of that, I thought the flourishes landed more. And by I say flourishes, I mean, and this was an episode directed by Nathan Fielder, there's a moment when Asher and Whitney are talking, you know, presumably mic'd, but we don't know that. And they've chosen to talk privately in the shade of a nearby house. And Fuller sets up a two-shot where you see them from the outside, but then we're also seeing them from the inside of the house where a woman is just watching television. Mm-hmm. And that was straight up Lynch. That was super David Lynchy, and I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
And it did not feel showy to me, the way that, like, him stopping episode two to pour Gatorade on himself
yes.
felt like, this is an episode of a Nathan Fielder show now, not The Curse.
Right.
It felt of a piece with it. But also, it allowed it to sort of be more settled, I thought, in the satire. So the way we went, it was like, it was a sitcom in that the comedy was coming from the situation, and the situation was the falseness of touring people through the house. So the first time, it's the people who actually were about to buy it, and they're like, I'm hot.
Yeah.
I don't like this. The second time is, I forget the woman's name, it's the native artist that has this,
Kara.
Like,
yeah.
Kara, this intense, like, frenemy, but mostly enemy relationship with Whitney and her behavior. And then when they start just grabbing people from the street and the guy stops it to sing because all he wanted to do was be on television is so funny. And then ultimately, your guy, Dean Cain.
The Blue Lives Matter homie, yeah.
But, like, first of all, the casting of Dean Cain,
yeah.
who is himself a reserve police officer in a small town in Idaho.
I did not know that.
I Wikipedia'd. I'm sure it's accurate to the moment. But I would say, just broadly speaking,
if you were going to be a small town police officer anywhere, yeah. would it be Idaho?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Idaho.
Yeah.
And no, I don't know. I don't think I would.
What kind of calls do you think he's getting?
Chill.
Yeah.
Real chill. But maybe to his point, it's the sticker on the character's car. Like, he's probably, when he gets called, he might be welcomed. You know,
right.
we don't know. No, but I mean, again, a cursory Google suggests that Dean Cain is in somewhat aligned with the character that he's playing in terms of his own personal donations. But that, what the satire worked for me, where it's just like, this guy loves this house.
Right.
And it, in that
he's
moment,
like, tell me you didn't change the bathroom. And he goes in and he's like, I'm gonna need a few minutes.
But it was all of the things at once. Like, that yeah. was, for me, the show becoming a successful TV show, because I was in it. I was with the characters. It was funny. I'm thinking about the intensity and weirdness of selling something that you made, your art or your commerce. You're thinking about the falseness of television. You're thinking about the impossibility of aligning everything perfectly with your preferred online politics. Like, it all worked.
Yeah.
And I was excited for that moment, because it felt like the show had been doing 100 things, some of them well, all of them interesting, and then succeeded.
Yeah. All right. I feel like we could put a pin in that.
But by the way, I did not expect, after watching the pilot, that I would be in for 10 episodes of the show, that I would be consistently intrigued and drawn back to it.
What do you think that is? Because I was looking at, I was thinking about what's on, and there's a few other things that are airing right now, like For All Mankind, which, you know, I fell behind on to an almost fatal degree, and yeah. now kind of, to be completely candid, like, we'll check in on from time to time if there's, like, a really significant episode being bandied about, but feel like I'm following along sort of through recaps, which is sad, but it's also what I'm doing.
But that's a show, I have not watched any of the season, but, like, it seems unique to me in that I don't really have a complaint. I liked everything that I saw of it, and I have no fire
motivation
in me
to do it, yeah.
to keep watching.
Monarch, which I don't think you ever checked out. That's the Russell family.
I took that week off. Are you enjoying it?
Zilla movie, yeah. And then I was looking at The Ringer, and people should be doing this too, The Ringer streaming TV guide, and the top 10 right now are the shows that I mentioned: Fargo, The Curse, Slow Horses, Murder at the End of the World, For All Mankind, Monarch, and three animated shows: Invincible, Blue-Eyed Samurai, and Scott Pilgrim, none of which I am watching. I would also throw Gilded Age in there. Gilded Age I watch every Sunday with my wife, and we have a delightful time. Of all those shows, I am surprised that The Curse seems to be the thing that you're other than Slow Horses, that you're most reliably like,
well,
I'm coming here for my daily vitamins.
I think there's a reason for it. I mean, out of that list, This has just been an odd end of the year, and part of it is strike related, but also it might be just a glimpse of what TV might be like for a while as it figures itself out,
yeah.
or hopefully as the industry figures itself out. I mean, Slow Horses is so exceptional, and I cannot wait for a new episode every week. So that's my clear number one. I think the curse is still rolling because for all the reasons I just said, I think it's achieving something and it's interesting, and Emma Stone's performance, attention must be paid to that too. But it's very, very odd and unique. And I just am becoming more attuned to the fact that that might be something slipping out of TV.
Yeah.
And I think of it this week because, as I said, I'm catching up on stuff that I missed in anticipation of our year-end show.
Watching some Beef, weren't
you? I was watching Beef. Yeah. That was the other thing that I watched of the week. What are we doing? Watched of the weekend? I watched this weekend. Did you brand it? Do we have
the
music
watch
for
of
that?
The weekend?
Kaya, can we get into that?
Kaya was not. We did not prepare Kaya for
it. You didn't prepare me for it.
Remember when we used to do like who won the week, like when we were doing Hollywood Perspectives, right?
Yeah.
Well, the watch of the weekend. TBD if we're going to change that.
I think Dak Prescott won the week, unfortunately. And as did Chris, who's been reliably riding Dak in fantasy. No wonder you're so chill.
I was wondering if you're going to bring that up.
No.
I lost anyway. It's okay.
I'm sorry, buddy. I think the real... You know the thing where it's just like, I don't have a drinking problem. And then like the guy you think who's your friend who maybe drinks too much is like having club soda. And you're like, uh-oh, that was me watching our buddy Zach Barron's face when Jalen Hurts fumbled. And Zach seemed by and large fine and content in his life and like happily playing with his son.
Yeah.
And I was like skinning my own hand. Like, oh,
you're the problem.
Hi,
it's you.
I'm the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching Beef and I'm pretty intrigued by it, and I'm sorry that I didn't watch it along with the rest of America 8 months ago or whatever. But the thing that I was really grabbed by was, oh, here's something again.
Mm-hmm.
This looks different. It feels different. The energy's different. It was surprising. Now,
yes.
I think, you know, I've sort of picked up from the discourse and a little bit from talking to you that people's mileage may vary on the long distance mileage of that show, right? That it may
sure.
not have worked across the season.
But I would say even in that, it still continues to go places. It's just, there is a version of that show that's 6 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And the season that they told, the story that they told, ends in a place where I think it warrants the length of the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that one of the refrains that we keep coming back to this season, this year, this moment, is much like with The Gold, where there were two Englands. Like, I wish there were more than two television Americas.
Yeah.
Like Slow Horses is absolutely exceptional good TV. And I don't mean that to take any credit away from it because I love it. It's my favorite thing. The Curse and Beef, and there, you know, we could throw a couple other things in there and we'll probably get into this on Thursday more, are super out there going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that too. My happiest place is when we cross the streams and we get something that I unabashedly love that is, you know, ticks all the boxes in terms of like production values and pacing and et cetera, respect for the audience in a certain way, but also makes you feel like you're on a rocket ship journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a little bit lacking. And I think that's also to a degree what you were alluding to with what we might, all the three of us in this room might discover on Thursday when we do our top 10, where it's like shared 4 and then 6, I don't know. Pick'ems.
Yeah. Let's end by talking about Sam's movie. Sam Esmail, new film. It's his second feature film, is that correct?
After Comet?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously was released on Netflix over the weekend. It's Leave the World Behind. It's an adaptation of Rumon Alam's novel of the same name. It stars Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, Mahala, Ethan Hawke, and Kevin Bacon. And is essentially about two families that find themselves thrown together in a Long Island vacation home as the country falls apart after essentially a cyber attack. What did you think of the film?
I think people know what I think of the film when they heard that Sam has been disinvited from our year. No, let's not make any drama about this. Sam is very busy with this movie, and that's why he's not coming on this week. We love him. The invitation is always open. And I mean, is it? Is it a kink that we like to be yelled at by him?
Especially at the end of the year.
It's the end of the year. It's like around the holiday time.
We really grinded out like 104 episodes, and then Sam comes in and is just like, you guys fucking suck.
Yeah,
like,
I think that's a good corrective for us, and I'm sure we'll get some of that energy again in our lives. So I really liked and admired this movie a lot. I was really unsettled by it. I was really happy that I've been saying this about a lot of movies, but I did see it in a theater, not at home. So I felt really, really drawn in to a degree that I think really suited the mood and the tenor of the movie. Big picture, I was so thrilled to see a end of the world movie that was just about people, that was focused. I think that we've spent so much time watching Sokovia's rise and fall. That like just to drill down on what it might be like as a lived experience, especially as all of us had a kind of preview of this in 2020 of like just being trapped in a place and then not knowing what you can trust and not knowing what's going on outside your window, really. I thought it was really, really effective on that. I think as someone who knows Sam well and has worked with him well, I felt like the first 10-20 minutes of the movie, I was like, oh, this is, I'm kind of triggered, like being in an edit bay with Sam,
right?
For his stuff, not mine, because it's very Sam and it's very intense, and he's such a brilliant technician and has such a keen sense of camera and camera movement, and he works so well with his DP Todd Campbell that like I felt almost overwhelmed by it.
Sure. There's a lot of ideas in the first half hour of the movie.
Yes.
Both cinematically and also in terms of like how the story is going to
be. And needle drops and all these things. And it felt very, very busy. And I was giving me a little bit of like heart palpitations, which, by the way, are suitable for a movie like this and its subject matter. But what I was really struck by was after those opening 10, 15 minutes, I felt like everything calmed down and focused on what we had, what he had, which is an absolutely galactic quality cast and a great story. And I dialed into it from that point.
Yeah, I thought that I had a similar feeling, which is like and we're going to get into spoilers here, obviously, for this film. It's on Netflix. I think a lot of people watched over the weekend that would be listening to this pod. So I would just say that first half hour is, I think, intentionally busy and intentionally overwhelming on a sensory level, because he's going to get to a point where this group of characters are now going to be without a lot of the devices that are creating this noise.
Yeah.
And winds up being sort of a theme of the film, is by the time Ethan Hawke's character Clay tries to go into town to find help, his GPS is no longer working. His phone is no longer working. He gets lost because he just doesn't even understand where he is, like most of us would now without maps on our phones. The kids are addicted to their devices and playing video games and watching Friends reruns. But like, as those devices die, as they get away from that, some of the things that they have learned from those devices actually become useful. But for the most part, the kids are just kind of like left to their own devices. And
no pun intended.
And in some ways, their return to nature like affects them quite, it has quite an impact on them, because the sun gets the deer tick bite and winds up getting quite sick. I thought that the coolest thing about this movie might also be the thing that some people don't like about it, which is that Sam made some fucking choices. He made some choices about how the story was going to be told tonally with like camera work, but also like the way the dialogue was written and the way the dialogue was performed, especially by Julia Roberts, is not going to be for everyone. And I thought it was pretty brave to take someone who is still in some ways considered America's sweetheart and make her essentially like a real abrasive personality who never really quite gets to the point where you're like, now she's the hero, except for that one moment with Mahala with the deer, I guess. And I just really admire the choice. I think some people are going to watch this and be like, why are people talking like this? But I think that what he's really doing is distilling communication down to a very like kind of like what's the important thing for this person to say level, rather than adorning it with like a lot of like cool, fun, overlapping dialogue and like references to things.
I mean, we haven't read the book. I've heard the book is brilliant. I've heard varying opinions from people who love the book, what they think of the movie. But one thing that I deeply respect is that Sam made his own movie.
Yep.
And I think that he's talked about the importance of that in adaptation. He's talked to me about that when we were working together. I think Ruman Alam seems like in very good spirits about this movie, seems to be on board with it, and I think respects and appreciates that it's something distinct. Sam rightfully gets a lot of credit for being technically talented, and he truly is, and this is a virtuoso show of that on the big screen or on your Netflix screen. But I think that his two most underrated talents are also on display here. One is exactly what you're alluding to, which is he believes in making big choices. And that sounds like sort of a facile comment, but I think in this industry, when there are a lot of competing forces and headwinds pushing you towards something safe, pushing you towards compromise, I think that whether it's just being stubborn or whether it's his artistic vision or some combination of both, he does not bow to that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works out wonderfully. Sometimes maybe it doesn't. Your mileage may vary, but I appreciate that as in him as an artist. The second thing is he works really well with really good actors and I think uses them really well. And the relationship that he has with Julia Roberts and the trust they have with each other was pretty fascinating on display here, because I think he ran towards something, right? Which, from what I understand, and I apologize because I haven't read the book, is that the character is abrasive. He cast America's Sweetheart in that role to do something with that role. And I thought he was rewarded with one of the best performances I've seen from her in a while.
The other one that I would say is Homecoming. So he clearly has unlocked something and maybe even rekindled an interest in her in making pretty interesting work.
And she
could really coast and still be making rom-coms and doing whatever. She could even just be on Big Little Lies or something if she wanted to. But she's doing pretty interesting work with Sam. I wanted to ask you about something that is, I think, a Sam invention from the story and might seem a little myopic, but it becomes basically the climax of the film and the final scene, which is, so this younger daughter of the Ethan Hawke and Julia Roberts character of Amanda and Clay, they have two kids, and the daughter's name is Rosie.
Kids are good, too. The cast is great.
And a running bit throughout the movie is this kid's desire to finish Friends. They have been rewatching Friends. They are really young. The daughter is she wants to visit the coffee shop, and Ethan Hawke's I don't think that place is real. I think it's just a set. Goes on and on. She loses the Wi-Fi signal, so she can't watch it on streaming. She keeps asking if they can find it on reruns and to explain reruns. But television commentary actually winds up playing a big part in this story. And then it ultimately concludes with Amanda, the Julia Roberts character, and Ruth, the Mahala character, are looking for Rosie, who's this younger daughter. And it turns out she has found a mansion near where they are staying, broken into it, then found a safe bunker, like a panic room bunker, where that this person is built for this very reason, for an apocalypse, gone down there. And it turns out that the person has a wall of DVDs of old TV shows, and she's able to finish Friends. And that is how the movie ends. Mm-hmm. And I will say, in my living room, there was a real what the fuck exclamation, as I'm sure there were in living rooms and movie theaters across the world. What did you think Sam was trying to say with that end?
I was thrilled by that.
Okay.
I mean, the literal
end of the story is this kid gets
to see
Friends.
Oh, I thought it was great. I mean, I thought there were a couple things. I mean, to be clear, I think Sam does a good job making it evident to the viewer that all the characters are headed towards that bunker, that they will be recreating, or at least sheltering in place in that place, even though we only follow Rosie's discovery of it. One thing that we know about Sam as our friend and as a filmmaker, and this was very much true in Mr. Robot, is the comforting role media has played in his life. You know, there's a huge thing about Back to the Future for the Elliot character in Mr. Robot. Mm-hmm. Sam himself is a dictionary of the movies of our shared, we're the same age as him, of our shared childhood and adolescence. I think the idea of taking solace in made-up lives and in a way that feeling like a hopeful thing, that there is still something to lose yourself in, is relevant to him and who he is as a person. I think that's a personal touch, even though people who listen to this podcast at the end of the year, all years except this year, know that he's pretty disdainful of mass market television?
Well, I think he's definitely disdainful of the idea of having television on as like a distraction or a nightlight, but he is not disdainful of television as a medium.
True,
but
true.
He's disdainful of shows that are manufactured to be done, we say, folding laundry television.
Yes, but I also think that I thought it was a really appropriate place to end a movie that is not making anything okay. Like the world has ended, essentially. The world as we know it and as these characters know it have ended. I thought this gave us a glimpse of the closest thing to a happy ending that would be possible. But that in of itself is, well, it's a little dark.
It's a pretty... I think that there's some ambiguity to the ending. It's interesting to me that you're like, we are to assume that they're all going to make it there and that they're all going to then live out their days in this... like well-appointed bunker.
Well, yeah.
Because I think I would make the argument that that kid is, the son is still sick.
Mm-hmm. He got medicine, quote unquote.
Yeah. Amanda and Ruth are watching the city be destroyed with bombs.
But they're also 5 minutes from that house.
Okay. And...
because they saw, Rosie saw the house from that same shed.
Yes. And that Rosie has... you know, obviously terrified the people in her family by prioritizing seeing how Friends ends over making sure her mom's okay or finding her brother or her father or any of that.
Yeah.
Which I know is like a trope that like kids can sometimes just like lose themselves and like forget like what time it is. But I almost wondered whether there was like a, the world is ending and we are drugging ourselves on mass media.
Oh, I think that's part of it too.
Yeah.
No. I don't mean it's a happy ending. I think I found it to be a settled ending, and you know, I don't think there's. I think happiness is off the table.
And that this kid feels more connected to these people on this show than she does to her family.
The thought of being left alone with them. Yes. Yeah. I think that that's also there. I think the fact that all of these things are in play, and my takeaway from the movie was a potpourri of all those different energies. But he still found a way to land it in a way that, to me, felt narratively satisfying to what I've been watching. And I smiled. I was like, oh, I thought it was clever. I think, what's that episode? It's like The One Where It Ends or something is the name of that.
Yeah, the last one.
The last one is what it's called. Yeah, exactly. I really liked that. I also thought there was just some bravura set pieces. Like
the drone dropping the flyers is pretty awesome. That car chase.
That super Hitchcockian car chase that Ethan Hawke has.
The Teslas
I thought was absolutely jaw-dropping.
Yeah, I, and one of the I'd best sequences. I've never seen that before.
Exactly. Yeah. I've never seen that.
No, but like, only been around
but the
years.
Idea of it, and also in that it is a beautifully constructed visual set piece that is emotionally relevant and tied to the context and the theme of the movie, I thought was really powerful and really well shot. The Mahershala on the beach sequence.
Oh, with the planes.
And I also thought he is just god-tier movie star in terms of his charisma. And Ethan Hawke is settled into this. We talk about him every few weeks, it seems like. And just he's so present and comfortable being the people that he's being asked to be.
So Ethan Hawke in his real life is a Brooklyn Nets fan.
Yes.
Living wherever he lives, I imagine in Brooklyn. This character, Clay, and Amanda, they live in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. Park Slope.
Yeah.
And when we see Clay for the first time, he's waking up, and what does he have next to him on his nighttime
table? I'm glad you're talking about this.
It's a 76ers mug. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's for us?
Yes.
You do think that Sam Esmail was like, what basketball team do Chris and Andy like? That's the one that Clay should like?
Well, he was like, this guy is doomed.
Okay.
Let's foreshadow his inevitable sadness and disappointment by giving him the mug of a team that's never going to quite
you're still
have
really
a happy
in that
ending.
Headspace.
That said, though, and I'm curious, I would like to read the book, and I'm curious about people who have read the book. The one thing that I'm still trying to sort out whether it tracked for me was it seemed like, at least in the log line and in the trailer and stuff, that one of the essential things of the book is that even if the world is ending, we can't let go of our bullshit.
Uh-huh.
And that was evidenced by the Black family. In this case, it's a father and a daughter showing up at the Airbnb.
Yes.
And the sort of, we don't trust you, we don't know you. That piece of it felt a little bit neutered to me in the movie. And I don't really know why, whether it's just the expediency of like, we need to get the story moving, we need to get this moving in other places, whether it's the Julia Roberts of it, but like the full-blown Karen-ness of the situation, of the potential for that, which I think, which to me felt like the spark of what I understand the book to be, and I realize how annoying that must
you
be.
You should
for people
do
who have read it.
Like your convention. Mm. Like, you know, people do these cons.
Yeah.
You should do a convention where it's just people who have read the book coming up to you at a signing table and telling you what the book is about.
And telling me, no, just, but also then like kind of telling me what I'm wrong about.
Yeah.
Like it just, because Sam didn't do it this year. So people, but anyway, but do you know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. but that also might be an example of something that ultimately I am on the side of, even if it doesn't always work, which is Sam took this and made his version of it
uh-huh.
and what motivated him and what interests him. And I'm not really against that. I thought it was I think it was largely a very successful movie.
What last sports question.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel when you saw Kevin Bacon wearing a Cowboys hat? In Long Island. I asked Sean,
yeah.
are there Cowboys fans on Long Island? And he was like, you may have heard of Cousin Sal.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I think there are, front-running types everywhere.
Well, that guy was pre-prepared. Much like Mike McCarthy last night. Kevin Bacon seemed really prepared.
I'll say that I saw the movie like 3 weeks ago.
And you're like, ah, the Cowboys.
I was like, that's cute. At least he has that to take with him into the next world. Now it's like, joke's on me.
Yeah, you just got your Sixers mug and Lyme disease.
I would have just approached him differently than Ethan Hawke did. I would have put the mug over my heart.
I gotta like, say, I would be you. So fucking mad if the world was ending and I went down with Lyme disease.
But wasn't the implication that he also had the like...
The sonic waves. The what would they call it?
Well, I don't remember what it was called.
But it was like Havana Syndrome.
That's Havana Syndrome.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I thought Havana Syndrome was like...
I would be disappointed if there was like a big battle for the soul of the country and I had Havana Syndrome.
I can tell you one thing you would be more disappointed about.
Hmm.
If you had spent $2.6 million on a safe room but then not been vacationing there that weekend.
Yeah.
That would have been...
Yeah.
That's the ultimate L.
Yeah.
Where you're like, God, I just hope some children were in the Airbnb next door.
They really wanted to watch Friends. Why don't we wrap it up there? On Thursday, we're going to be doing our Best TV of the Year episode. The yeah. following Monday, a very special episode about the best episode of television.
The episode of the year episode.
Yes.
This is a new thing we're doing.
And we have some special guests for that one. So we're very excited about the next couple of watch episodes.
I realize we're pressed for time now, but Kai, I just want to check in with you too. What's the tenor going to be between the three of us on Thursday?
Yeah, like, have you decided how combative and adversarial you're going to be?
I think like maximum just to, you know, try to fulfill Sam's role.
Yeah, it's just a character.
Yeah, but if it's mask off for Kaya.
I mean, yeah, it's just like no hard feelings.
All right, dipshits. This is what you got wrong this year.
Enough already.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Kaya for producing us. We'll be back on Thursday with our best TV of the year episode. And until then, everybody... Mm-hmm. Stay hungry. It's a long NFL season.
It's a long season.